The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
And hello, good morning to you. It's just approaching 4 minutes past nine on this Friday, the 21st of July. You're welcome along to the last 9 till noon show of the week. I'm going to introduce our Friday panel for you shortly, but we want you involved in the conversation as well, so get your views into us. 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number, 086 60 25,000. Outside the Republic, 00 353 86 60 25,000. If you want to give us a call, 07491 25,000. As I say, we want your views and opinions as well. Right, let us say hello to our Friday panel. Good morning first to Michael McLaughlin, Branch Secretary of the Donegal Labour Party. Good morning to you, Michael. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Greg. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you on board. Dr. Kieran O'Farrie, General Practitioner. Good morning, Kieran. How are you keeping?
Morning, Greg. How are you? Thanks very much for
having
me.
Very good. And we welcome back onto the show Grainne Hines, Member of Letterkenny Active Retirement. Hiya, Grainne.
Morning, Greg.
Good to see you. Good to have you back on the show. People are struggling, as we've heard this week, to get a GP's appointment. Some being told it'll be a month before they are seen. Others are struggling to even get registered with a GP, as they say they are full to capacity. We spoke to one lady, Hannah, yesterday, who has been in Ireland, living in Ireland for a number of years and been trying to get access to a GP for a year. She's being told there's simply no capacity. And this is before free GP access is extended further. The government have plans to increase numbers, but some feel these initiatives will only really keep us where we're at, keep up to pace with, I don't know, people retiring or doing other things. So what can or should be done? It is a very worrying situation for many. And by a scheduling coincidence, we have a GP with us this morning, which is really quite convenient. So we'll start with you, I think, Dr. O'Farrie. I mean, it does vary from region to region, practice to practice, but there is an issue there in terms of capacity, is there?
Yes, I think capacity is an issue right across the country. I don't think there are too many practices across the country who are sitting around thinking, God, we've space to take on some more patients. Most people feel like they're at capacity or far above it. We've had a big increase in population, particularly over the last 2 years. There was an influx in population, and practices have taken on extra patients because of that. And just in general, I suppose we are all at capacity. You know, in my own practice, we're full every day. There's no such thing as an empty appointment. It just doesn't happen. We could probably see another 200 patients every day if we had the capacity or the space for it. So yeah, at the end of the day, capacity is the issue. But as you say, that does vary significantly from area to area as well.
Yeah, now some people text in then, and it's just great to have the opportunity to address this with someone in the know. They'll say that if you go into a GP practice now, there might be one or two people in the waiting room pre-COVID. There could have been 15 or 20. And that I don't know what they think is actually happening, whether they think you're in behind the doors twiddling their thumbs. But they do look at things like that and say, well, you know, maybe GPs are being selective with who they see or whatever. So could you address that type of commentary?
I don't see any basis at all for that, Greg. You know, so I looked at the figures in my own practice. Compared to 2019, we are seeing 20% more people every week. I've spoken to some neighbouring practices, and they've had similar figures of a 20 to 30% increase in their consultations. So I really don't see any basis for that. You know, I had patients in here yesterday with me, and they said, God, it's quiet out there today. So you know, maybe our waiting rooms are, I don't know, maybe we're better with timekeeping. And, you know, the old days where, you know, when I started as a GP working in parts of the county, the system was people came in, sat in the waiting room and waited till they were seen. So you'd have a full waiting room and it would twiddle down as the day goes on. People don't want to wait around now. So we have, you know, appointments in most practices. So realistically, if your appointment is at 9:15, you come in, the only people who should be in the waiting room are other people with appointments for around that 10 or 15 minute slot. So yeah, you don't expect to have a lot of people in the waiting room.
But I mean, obviously the health service is all intertwined in terms of what's going on in GP practices and what's going on in the hospital and then what happens in terms of NowDoc. And then you could even go on to, home care packages and what have you. And it's all multifaceted part of the health service. But there are a few initiatives to try and boost GP numbers across the country. As I say, I've spoken to people in the past that believe that that might just keep us where we're at and not necessarily relieve some of the issues that we're seeing right now. Looking to the medium, short to medium term future, Kieran, is there anything in there that gives you hope that we could see pressures on the GP services ease somewhat or make it easier to get more timely access?
I do think it's difficult. I think getting GPs is very difficult at the moment. If you're looking for short term cover, it's nearly impossible. We have a new doctor starting in our practice next week. That arrangement has been in place since last September, so it's taken that length of time for us to source another doctor to come in and work with us. And if you have short term issues like sick leave or whatnot in the short term, it's there's very, very little cover out there that you can get. So having, locum cover and that kind of cover is a big issue. Smaller practices where there's one or two doctors, it's more of an issue. And I think the government do need to look at some kind of system where there's either a pool of doctors who work in a locum capacity that practices can apply to or something like that. But, the short-term needs are one issue. The long-term issues then, as you say, there are more GP training places coming on board. That's going to take a number of years before we have fully qualified GPs for that. But trying to keep them in the county is another difficulty. We've had changes to the GP training scheme over the last number of years, which mean now that, the old system was that those who wanted to come to Donegal, often like myself, people from Donegal came and were more likely to stay. Now it's a national application, so it's not necessarily as easy to keep GPs who we train here in Donegal. And so I don't see any quick solutions or quick fixes to this. And I think, as you mentioned, with the increasing population who are going to have free access to GP care, I think the reality of that is that people are going to have to more likely wait longer to see their GP because of government policy and not because of GP actions.
All right, I'll come back to you, maybe tease that out a little further. But Grainne Hines, we talk about people who... aren't happy taking so long to see a GP, but I know people who simply don't even try to because they think it's a pointless exercise, which is worrying because obviously then if they're not getting seen for conditions that could worsen, that's a problem as well. Grainne, what's your view on this?
Yeah, well, in particular for older people, they find it quite difficult when they ring up the GP and they're sort of triaged by the girl at the desk, who usually is a lovely person, very obliging. But I think when older people ring the GP practice and they're brought up on the computer and it's perhaps over 70, maybe over 80, I think they should be automatically rung back by the doctor. And could I just make one point here? When you're ringing people back, which is very good, and they do that for older people, it would be nice if you had a video because everybody is on WhatsApp or FaceTime and older people like a face-to-face talk. Now, myself recently, I needed a very strong painkiller. Arthritis had sort of flared up and all I needed was a stronger painkiller than I could buy over the counter. And I had to waste the time. The doctor had to ring me back. Now, why could I not have gone to the pharmacy? Perhaps you could consider giving pharmacies more work for
Well, they're looking for it as well. I mean, pharmacists are looking for more responsibility, any I've spoken to anyway.
And they should be. And they practically, actually, pharmacists know a lot more about drugs perhaps than doctors. Doctors have the list, they have their list which they prescribe. But pharmacists have an in-depth knowledge of drugs, what drug you're on, what drug you can take, what you can combine. And certainly older people sometimes ring up. They get confused about what drugs they're on when they're talking to the doctor, especially if they're not on a face-to-face which is much more friendly. So,
but Grainne, just in relation to, you know, and we do hear it on this program time and time again about speaking to the nurse on the phone, or you know, people are concerned about their privacy and they prefer to have these conversations directly with the GP. Are those days gone, though, really, in that these are all professionals working within the practice? You know, certain roles and elements of work have been delegated to others. That, you know...
Yes, I think, you know, I think most people have... I don't see a big problem with that. Mm. But maybe some people would prefer if you had trained nurses, triage, and if you were put onto the nurse, maybe the nurse could deal with it. I also think nurses should have a lot more power. They should be able to set up their own clinics, as they are in Europe, and deal with people like me looking for painkillers, looking for maybe just reassurance of what's wrong with me type of thing. So I think that the nurses don't have enough, as much power here in Ireland as they have in other countries. They don't have the same. And they have this better training in some cases. So I think doctors should look at that. Now, a lot of people think the doctors are sort of trying to hang on to the power for themselves. And I mean, that is something here, and I don't know if that's prevalent or not, but they don't want to give the power out to nurses or pharmacists. They want to keep all that.
Well, we'll put that directly to Kieran, because it is quite a charge. I mean, there is some initiatives, I think, to get more nurses working in communities as well. Yes. But Kieran, would you welcome that more nurses and I suppose a greater responsibility, like we're seeing in Britain at the moment, whereby, you know, there are certain things that pharmacists are being given the okay to deal with that would take pressure off you guys? I don't think you're... would you have any resistance to that?
So, like, practice nurses are an integral part of the GP team, you know, and we couldn't survive without them. We've got four excellent practice nurses here in our practice who see full list of patients all day and every day. So it's not an issue that, you know, nobody's trying to hang on to power.
And they prescribe, and nurses are nurses here in Ireland allowed to prescribe drugs?
In certain situations, if you have to have certain qualifications, so if you're an advanced nurse practitioner, then you can prescribe. But at the end of the day, we have to remember the different roles that people have. A doctor is a doctor, a nurse is a nurse, and a pharmacist is a pharmacist. And they're three different roles. So absolutely, we can expand roles as much as possible. But if you look across the water at the minute in the NHS, and that's no model, and that's not a model that I would like to see here, the issue there is, you know, there's a campaign at the minute saying ask for the doctor. So, you know, there's a certain work that at the end of the day is going to be the doctor's duty. It's what we've been trained to do. It's what we're able to do, and it's what we're there to do. So you know,
don't have the time to do it, you can't do it. So therefore, you could give some of that responsibility across to practice nurses.
And our practice nurses run big parts of our program here in terms of smear taking, childhood vaccinations, chronic disease management programs. All that type of work is nurse led in GP practices, and so I don't think there's an issue that nursing skills aren't being utilized the time isn't being utilized.
What solution would you have to recruiting young doctors? Is it because they can't get accommodation, or they're not interested in GP work?
I want to bring Michael in. I appreciate Grainne but Michael McLaughlin, branch secretary of Donegal Labour Party, has been waiting incredibly patiently. Michael, come in there, please.
Thanks very much, Greg. There's a couple of things to raise from the conversation going on. First of all, Grainne, I do agree that for older people, it's very important to have face-to-face consultations. And particularly in a rural context, I think that becomes more and more important, can be some of the only interaction that older people can have. I mean, for us in the Labour Party, we welcome the Minister's announcement of 35% extra training places and raising the non-EU scheme from 50 to 250 GPs, and the idea that they're going to do their training in local areas. But I think that's more of a long-term thing. Moving on from what you were talking about there, and Kieran, I think you may have come across as well, that the Irish College of GPs have a number of recommendations of things that they think might help in the short term. And if you look at some of that, it's along the lines of what you're talking about. So you look at the increase of the role of the practice manager to take some of the business admin pressures off the GP, which I think could be useful. And another thing, which is touching on what we're talking about now, is to see the GP as the leader of an integrated care team that consists of nurses, pharmacists and other professionals. I think there's something that we could look at, and that's looking at duplicity in the system where, you know, is it a case that you have results coming back from a hospital or from various tests that perhaps a nurse could deal with, rather than my own uncle's a GP and I'm very aware of just the phenomenal level of the workload. And, you know, you see that it's practically a 24-hour job. And, you know, once you're finished with clinic, you're there dealing with all of these results and things that come back. So I wonder, is there space there to look at developing a role where someone can do with that kind of thing? But I think one of the big things we need to look at is the training. And in the ICGP report, they talk about creating a pipeline of medical graduates. And there's an interesting thing that I was struck by as I was reading something during the week, where in medical training, we kind of go contra flow. So medical students go to the hospital first as part of their training. And I wonder, would it change things if a medical student went to the GP first and then followed mm-hmm. that progress along? Does that then see the value of GP raise in training purposes, and so that a medical graduate come out may think of a GP career first? And I think that's an interesting thing to look at. And in terms of education anyway, I think we need to be strengthening the links between medical training colleges and GP practices and really see the value of a general practice career.
Yeah, but also obviously it's more attractive for people to work in healthcare in different parts of the world than it is here. So even if we increase training places, presumably we can't, you know, shackle them to a local GP centre. Is there any moral issue, Kieran, in us poaching medical professionals from other countries that don't necessarily have an abundance of them? Do you know what I mean, if you look at what is it, about almost half of our health service now is people that from outside the country, and every time we look for a solution, it seems to be to try and take the brightest and best from other parts of the world. I mean, is there a moral issue there?
I think you can make a very good moral argument for that. You know, if we're taking doctors who are trained in other parts of the world, but at the same time, the medical profession is a very international job. It's very movable, you know. I suppose I do want to come out a little bit of defense of general practice. I think all in all, compared to other parts of the world, and, you know, I think we provide very good services here. I think most people would agree with that.
Yeah, I think so.
I think, you know, people in general have good confidence in their GPs and their practice nurses. The GPs that I know in this county work very hard. I was talking to one colleague earlier this week who was still at work one night last week at 4 a.m. in the morning, which I know is hard to believe. But, you know, I spent 5 hours in here on Saturday doing paperwork so that when I am at work, I'm available to see my patients. But there's a massive hidden workload now in general practice. You know, people sometimes think, well, why can't I see the doctor right now? You know, there, for every patient that I see, there are five patients that are I'm getting letters back on, forms to fill on, blood tests back on, and more work has been transferred from secondary care to primary care.
But that makes it even more hard for people to understand that GPs accepted quite a lot of money, in fact, to take on extra GP visits, free GP visits, in full knowledge, really, that it is not going to provide any new spaces at all, really. A lot of people feel that what this means is that people who are already members of that GP practice will attend more frequently or just attend for free. So GPs knew that, know that in advance. It's not widening necessarily the GP services out to a greater amount of people, but it's going to put extra pressure on them, make it harder to get an appointment. But then there was this financial incentive to do so. Maybe should have held off and said, right, well, we actually can't do this.
I think the issue there, Greg, and I'm not sure the exact details of it, was that this was a plan that the government had. GPs, we don't have a union as such. So the IMO negotiated on behalf of GPs, but as far as I understand it, these extra cards were coming in whether we liked it or not. And, you know, we can't control government policy, and unfortunately, government policy is to make GP care free to more patients, which is going to make it more difficult for the patients that we have to get access, because there isn't an associated increase in capacity associated with that. You know, it's some of the cheapest parts of healthcare for the government to throw out free doctor visit cards. You know, if they were serious about it, they could give out medical cards, which obviously conveys extra levels of funding for patients, like the cost of their medication and that. But they haven't done that. And so this is going to make it more difficult. There's no doubt about that.
I mean, Grainne, we'll finish up on this and move on. But, you know, like, even just with the tone of messages that are coming in, even, to be honest with you, to some extent, with some of the what you have said, and even with some government action, there seems to be, I don't maybe think GPs are getting the respect and the credit they deserve for probably keeping the whole thing moving, the whole health service moving, at least at a certain level there. It seems to be like, you know, you're a GP, see me now. Or, you know, if you're the government, you're a GP, you better start seeing more people, or more people for free, or whatever it might be. Is there a... are we respecting GPs enough, I wonder?
There's a gap between what people are thinking and what is on the ground for the GPs. So the GPs can only do so much. They can't, they're not superhuman. They can't work 24 hours. So people really have to think of that. They also have to encourage their own children who become doctors to perhaps think of their country and stay here for maybe 3 or 4 years before they move abroad. I mean, you know, it's all to do with the morality of it and how, I mean, the people in Ireland will have to take charge. We as a population will have to look at problems and help. It's not all what the government can do, what the GPs can do. What can we do?
I don't know. I'm listening to what you're saying, right? But it sounds to me like the mindset is that this is some sort of a devotion or a... Do you know what I mean?
Other countries,
I think, see more value in our nurses and our teachers and our doctors.
Yes.
And offer. I mean, Michael, do you think the government could be doing more? Do you agree with Grainne that you know, put your country first, or wear the Irish jersey, or do you think it really is up to the government to make it?
I want to come back first of all and say that we do massively value and appreciate the work that GPs and all of our healthcare system do. And, you know, we saw that particularly through COVID and the fallout from the crisis of that. And I think anybody, you need to really not be listening or looking to see that there isn't problems and we aren't stretched to capacity. And I think as a patient, we have a responsibility to consider, do we need to do a GP appointment for this? Do we need to be looking? And similarly, we need to be going when we need to. And I think there is a responsibility all round here.
Yeah, but the problem is that we do know that if people have greater access to free GP care, they're less likely to think of that question that you just said, that you'll err on the side of the caution. You'll just go in to be on the safe side.
Well, sorry, could I just come in there? I know this may be a bit controversial, but people are paying 50 and 60p to see the GP. They have expectations. Like, my father was a GP and nobody ever paid him because nobody had money in the 50s and 60s. And people really respected him because they felt he was putting himself out for them and working. As you know, the old GPs were constantly...
Yeah, but in fairness, how big was his building? How many staff did he have? You know, how big was the tax liabilities? I don't know, but I mean, I think people think GPs, one man or one woman, with an old tattered leather bag with a stethoscope hanging out of it. I mean, these are massive businesses, aren't they?
The district nurse was the nurses were very active in those days. But what I'm saying is, when people pay money like that, they have expectations.
Okay, Michael, sorry, finish your point there, if you don't mind.
There is a relationship both between patient and the medical profession in general, where you need to consider what is the appropriate thing for you. And just to come back on that one, Grania, I think we need to acknowledge and accept that we're dealing with a much larger population, and also a significantly older population that has more complex and intricate care needs. So we're not necessarily comparing like for like in that instance, but you know, we anecdotally hear of people who've decided that they need an appointment for something that doesn't necessarily. And I think, you know, I don't know, are we overblowing some of the problems here, and are we going too far? Because as Kieran said, and I've lived in the UK for a long time previously, and certainly the system here works.
Well, that's really the kind of the way I kind of phrased a couple of questions and last words to you, Kieran. It's about really what people expect, you know, and with respect to Grania there, it's like, I pay my 60 euro, I want to see my doctor, you know what I mean? Like, is there an unfair expectation then on GP services, or maybe not an appreciation of the level of service we actually have?
I think, I suppose, my opinion in general is that when people need to see their doctor, they're facilitated in as much as possible. Obviously, there's a limit in every day, but I think in general, urgent cases are seen when they're needed. Obviously, that means that more routine care has to wait a little bit longer. So, you know, if you have to wait 2 or 3 weeks to have a routine appointment to follow up on your blood pressure, I don't think that's inappropriate. I think that's reasonable, so that we can then make sure those who need urgent appointments, who are acutely sick on the day, are more easily facilitated.
Yeah, OK. Thank you very much for that. Interesting conversation. Michael McLaughlin, Dr. Kieran O'Farrie and Grania Hines, back with more from them and your comments after the break. We're seeing extreme weather across the world, with July set to be the world's hottest in hundreds, if not thousands, of years. Our own region's getting warmer and wetter, according to Matarin, with more extremes of weather predicted, i.e. that rain doesn't necessarily fall all year round, but could empty the skies in 2 or 3 days. So, Michael, I'll start with you. Truthfully, now, I'm not saying you would ever be untruthful, but how concerned or worried are you about climate change, the climate crisis, however it wants to be phrased? Or is it just a story that keeps popping up on the news and you can't wait for it to be over so something interesting comes on? Not you specifically, but I suppose I'm sort of saying us as a people.
I'm hugely concerned, and I think as a people we need to be hugely concerned. We don't need to look very far to see that Europe is actually burning, and I think, you know, we need to accept responsibility in that, and we need to look at our own contribution to that as a problem. And fundamentally, we need to reduce our use and reliance on fossil fuels.
Yeah. Do you think we are moving in that direction?
I think we're making a lot of noise about moving in that direction. I'm not convinced that we're doing anything in any real terms. There's lots of conversations about it, but I mean, if we look at ourselves as a country, we have huge access or potential access to wind and renewable energy sources that I don't think we're doing enough fast enough on. We hear lots of interesting comments from government that seem to be large statements with not a whole lot to back it up. I mean, if you look at recent announcements and then you compare it to what's actually happening, if you look at the Norwegian providers who are leaving the market because are leaving Ireland because of issues around planning and regulation, it's just simply taking too long. And you know, we need to be looking, and we need Minister Ryan to be looking at changing those kind of planning ideas so that we can get access to offshore wind development quicker, easier, faster.
Is that ever really going to happen, only happen in any meaningful way in Ireland or any other country, when people will actually vote for, like, the worst thing you could do if you want to get elected right now in this country would be to say that we're going to reduce the national herd, we're going to tax you more, your big cars, we're going to, you know what I mean? No one's going to vote for that. So how do we make change whilst it's so politically unpopular to do these things?
First of all, I'm not as convinced as politically unpopular as you're making it. I think that we have lots of people who are very concerned, and our younger generations coming behind us are even more so concerned about the implications. And I think, frankly, we all should be concerned. But I think, you know, not just if we stay on the wind energy issue for a moment. And well, I mean, it's something that we have in abundance in Ireland, and particularly in Donegal. And I think, you know, if we have access to a natural resource, why aren't we using it rather than paying extortionately high prices to bring energy from other
places? Again, just in terms of the policy, we have sort of about 37-38% of our energy is actually generated through wind and solar. But we've signed some crazy agreement, which means that we guarantee the producers of that electricity the same rate as we pay for gas.
Agreed.
You know what I mean? So, like, we're not seeing any benefit from it.
Not at the moment, but I think we could, and I think that comes back to this whole notion of planning and regulation that we're not doing, and we need to seriously be looking at that and changing that as a process.
Grainne, I mean, how concerned are you about climate change?
I'm very
the climate
concerned.
Crisis?
What you just said there, that having wind farms doesn't give as much economic, you know, for us, for ourselves, but what it is reducing our carbon footprint, and that's what we are about. We're not about getting it cheaper. And if we can decarbonize our national gas supplies, which you can do by water can be split into hydrogen and oxygen, the hydrogen can be used to decarbonize that, and therefore there's no CO2 emissions. Those are the things we have to look at. And having worked in the third world, this is where we have to look at. We have to look at India, we have to look at Africa, we have to look at South America. And we have to look seriously at how they are producing their energy. Now, you may, the terrible word in nuclear, but nuclear is very efficient at producing carbon footprint. And that has to be something that has to be looked at in the third world. And also the decarbonisation of their gas.
It's the first. It's often countries like Africa that are. It's not they that are causing the problems.
No,
it's us causing the problems,
it. Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's they that have to endure the climate change.
Like I, as a even an older woman like I am, my carbon footprint is way above what the carbon footprint of third world people are. Like we travel, we use all the gadgets. We use up so much. Our carbon footprint personally is far too big, and we have to look at that as well. But on the global stage, we have to seriously look at the third world, where there is huge populations, and see what you can do to provide them with energy and water. And water is another problem in the world at the moment. So that is what we have to do. We have to look at it globally, but we also have to look at it ourselves.
Yep. I think here, part of the problem is that many of us just live in the now. We're trying to deal with everyday struggles and to try and focus our minds on stuff that will cost us more in the short term, but sort of plan for a future. I think
you have to think of your children. Yeah, even if you have to reduce what you do or how you travel or what you eat, that is going to be of benefit to your children and your grandchildren.
Okay.
So we have to spend our money. We have to buy less clothes. We have to travel less.
But the point is, Grainne, the difficulty is we see the leaders of all these countries flying around the world in the private jets to these COP conferences, rolling 5 or 6 Humvees off the back of aeroplanes. Sure, they're flying all over the place, right? They're doing whatever they want to do, and then you say, well, what we need to do is eat different, and but that's the also the problem with some of the messaging. Why should we?
I agree.
Why should we when China's building more coal-fired electricity generation? But anyway, I don't agree with that, but this is part of the problem with messaging.
China are actually now facing up to that because of the high temperatures they've had this summer. They are facing up to having, in fact, they've done quite a lot to reduce the carbon footprint. Mm. So they have realised they can do it.
Michael, go ahead.
I think we can't get into that argument of, well, others aren't doing it.
Yeah,
so
Michael, we have to, because that's the that's the discussion that's happening in houses, you see. So I don't think I don't think there's any point in having conversations on the radio.
I wasn't saying we shouldn't have that conversation here. I'm saying us as citizens and citizens of a
first world country. But we are, though, Michael. You see, that's
But I'm saying that we shouldn't be. I mean, if we want to do that, do we want to compare our human rights record with China? No, we're not doing that. So why are we doing this? And I think that it is time for us as a country and as a Western world and as a world in general, we need to take, we're back to again to responsibility and say, okay, it is my social responsibility to do something about this and to be a leader in this and to say, this is where we're going. We don't look to China very much for any other leadership. So why would we compare ourselves to China?
Or America or Canada. America and Canada, both massive polluters, particularly Canada. And they're so nice up there. Kieran, what do you think? As I say, you know, we were just talking about access to GP, and that's sort of like the here and now, and what will keep you awake at night. I mean, is the world going on fire? Really bothering people enough to actually start making real changes?
I think it's terrifying, personally. Yeah. I really do. You know, we can all talk about individual decisions, and individuals will make decisions based on the here and now. And we need government to step in and direct policy. Nothing makes things change more than government policy and national policy. You know, I voted Green in the last election because I was afraid of this. I think they've brought a very good voice to the table, and I'd hate to think of how little we would have done if they weren't there, because I still think we're not going far enough. We're not making the necessary changes in the agricultural sector, with fossil fuels, with transport. Everything, as Michael said, with wind farms is moving far, far too slow. You know, this needs to be treated like an emergency actions. And, you know, nothing changes our mind more than government policy. You know, if we need to eat less meat, then the government needs to help us do that. If we need to drink less milk, the government needs to help us do that. You know, we can all make individual decisions, but national policy is what will actually change things.
And whilst it remains unpopular to have those policies, though, you know, I mean, are we going to fight the next general election on who's going to increase taxes and incentives more to stop us eating meat and drinking more milk and driving our cars? You know, it's not going to be what an election is run on, because you would be crazy. You wouldn't get a vote.
Well, and you can see that Eamon Ryan is often the bogeyman and poked fun of, when he's probably, you know, I would argue, making very brave decisions that aren't necessarily popular, but are right and just and morally right. And I would hope that more and more politicians can be brave, stand up and do what needs to be done, because not the right thing isn't always the popular thing.
All right, back with more after the break. All right, a lot of coverage today of criminality in Dublin. The Justice Minister reacting very quickly to pledge to address the issue. So it's only a matter of time now before we have the Garda Commissioner holding a press conference, I'm sure, outlining the targeted policing response to these issues in Dublin, because that's where the media is based and that's the way things seem to go. There's been calls for more resources to tackle crime in Donegal, and action to tackle the scourge of drugs seem to be falling on deaf ears, though there's plenty of coverage of the discovery of the cocaine washed up on the North Donegal coasts over the last couple of days. I suppose two questions. I take it, Michael, I'll start with you, if that's okay. Michael McLaughlin, Branch Secretary of Donegal Labour Party. I take it you still feel safe in Donegal, but why then are public opinions, elected representative opinions, about the level of policing in Donegal falling on deaf ears? Is it our distance from the capital? And actually, senior Garda calls for more resources, I should say, actually, locally.
And so in answer to your first question, yes, I do feel generally safe in Donegal. I think something that we can all agree on is that we may not be seeing the same level of physically seeing the same level of policing as we did before, and maybe we're coming back to something similar things that we were talking about at the beginning of the program, where we have a larger population, we have resources that are being stretched, and so you're not necessarily seeing a beat on the street, as it were, in the same way as
well, where are they, what are they doing then?
I think we've got a very stretched force that are working very hard to maintain safety and to deal with criminality that we don't necessarily see on the street in the same way as we did before. If we look, I mean, you mentioned the drug problem, that's seriously something that we we have to concern ourselves with, and it's seriously something that's happening in our local area, and I think we're fooling ourselves if we think it's not.
All right, but we don't really have a targeted drug squad here in Donegal anymore that's well-resourced. You don't see foot patrols in our towns and villages. I'm not sure how often you get stopped at a checkpoint. So if the Gardaí's resources are stretched, where are they? And I'm not, this is a question, not a statement, by the way. So where are they and what are they doing?
That's not. Are you asking me if they're not in Donegal? Where are they?
No, I mean where? What? You know what I mean? Like they're. You're saying that the resources are stretched and things have changed. The population is greater and maybe they can't be out in the streets as much. But what are they doing? Are you saying they're in the regions around the county tackling crime, and that's why people say that you don't see Garda patrols in the Twin Towns or Buncrana or Letterkenny like you used to deter criminal activity?
I think that there's a lot of criminal activity going on that we don't necessarily come in contact with as a general populace, so we may not see what's happening there. I think if you go down the main street in Letterkenny on a Saturday night, you're going to see a very hefty guard presence, and I think that, so, you know, it's visible there. I think that otherwise, you know, to answer your question, am I seeing checkpoints with the frequency that I used to know? What am I saying? I don't think that we have the resources in a county the size that we have in Donegal necessary to maintain a Garda presence that we need to have, and we need to see more of that.
Yeah, and indeed that is a call that is coming from, or has come from, senior Gardaí in the county. Absolutely. As well, because they are advocating for more resources. Dr. Kieran O'Farrell, I presume you still feel safe in Donegal, and have you any concerns about policing in the county or the level of it?
I do feel safe. I think it's a great place to raise children. And when I see some of the stories in Dublin, I'm very thankful that we live in Donegal. I think the Garda presence and the visibility is definitely not what it used to be. I can't remember the last time I was stopped on the road and had any checks done. So I think if our senior Gardaí are calling for more resources, then I think they probably need them. And anecdotally, as you say, I think we all feel that the presence that used to be there isn't there. But again, a lot of that work goes on behind the scenes now, and it's not all like in a lot of professions, what they used to do and what they do now can be very different. And there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes that people don't see.
Yeah. But I mean, our calls now are triaged in Galway. So if you ring up and say, you know, such and such is happening here and there, if it's not an emergency response, you're sent to Galway and they'll process it and all that type of stuff. So that work's being done outside the county. So I'd be very curious to know, you know, where these resources are going and what they're being tied up doing. I'm not suggesting for a second that people are twiddling their thumbs, but I do recall this is an issue that used to come up in the Dáil an awful lot. And this is no particular political party or whatever, but I know Pat the Coat Gallagher used to raise this issue very regularly in the Dáil. He would talk about figures, how many were there. We just don't seem to be getting that level of advocacy for the Gardaí in the Dáil that we used to once. But Grainne, I know you feel safe in Donegal, don't you? But are you concerned about the level of policing?
Yeah, I feel safe and I feel there should be more police. But I also feel that the drug of choice has changed from cocaine to crack, and from heroin to crack cocaine. Kieran would know about this. And crack cocaine makes people much more on the edge and much more violent. And the police have an awful lot to deal with this violence that is on the street now from drug addicts. And it's very difficult for them to know how to deal with that. So I think your point about drug control and somebody in charge of that is very important. And that's very important to increase and to establish a proper group to work with that and to work with the guards. And the guards have no way of protecting themselves. Like if somebody touches them even now, they are taken up for assault. You know, they've been suing them and they're complaining. So it's not as easy as it was for guards to patrol and to feel safe themselves and to know that they are protected. And we do need a much, and we need guards on the streets, not in cars or not. So we do need them, and I think we should get them. But I also think we have other problems that are causing.
Of course, and we've talked about that extensively in the show. I just find it frustrating that you know, we have had concerns about, you know, what a perceived rise in criminality in Letterkenny. Not much will get done about it. And yet now, because the issues are in Dublin, we've got the Justice Minister speaking about it. We've got the, as I say, the inevitable Garda Commissioner statement that's going to be coming out shortly. And I just would like to see the running of the police, if it's OK for me to say, you know, based on not necessarily what's in the headlines of the newspapers. I'll stay with you. We've only got a couple of minutes on this one, Grian. Your various studies and research point to a world which is leaving many older people behind. We heard this week that a large number of older people don't like the move towards self-service checkouts in shops. In fact, I think that was last week. But that's not necessarily a generational issue people have, and there are issues with booking bus tickets online, cash at GAA grounds and so on. Just given your role in Letterkenny Active Retirement, do we need to analyse that this is the actual way we want to go as a society, rather than presuming this is all progress, which is, I think, is where we're at the moment?
No, I think we should think long and hard about that, because it is socialisation is almost at null point at the moment for older people and for people who get on the phone. Like, you get on the phone to do something about your TV, and you don't have a conversation. I mean, you're on waiting for half an hour. When you get through, you put press A, press B, press C. And when you get through to the person concerned, you're dealt with very abruptly. And I don't know, it isn't, older people are finding this very difficult to deal with. There is, as you know, in Europe, slow checkouts. And that is something that the Older People's Council, which I'm also on, are trying to deal with at the moment. We're going to go around the supermarkets and see, can they have a checkout, a slower checkout for people who you know, maybe aren't quite physically or mentally.
Yeah, but I would like that too. And I don't mean that in any way. You know, this race to fill the trolley and the bags and all of that kind of stuff, it's not something I enjoy at all. And as I say, I'm not being facetious there. I know it's a very important issue you talk of, but I don't really enjoy that whole experience. I'll come back to you if I have time. Dr. Kieran O'Farrie, I mean, like, I just think there's ironically, Grania, AI will probably hard to be shortly when you're ringing up institutions. It'll be hard to tell the difference between a computer answering the phone and a human. But Kieran, I just think we presume that we all want this progress, and we've never really had a national conversation about what kind of society do we want to live in, and how much of it do we want it to be automated.
Yeah, like as you said, the stress of going and doing the shopping now and trying to get things into your bag before they fall off the end of the till is a sign of the life we live now. Everything is rushed. Trying to get talking to people is impossible. The banks, everything is being more automated, and that is making us, I suppose, in general, it makes us more and more isolated. People sit at home more. They do more on their computer. There's less interaction with other people, and then that has an effect on us as a people, where people are more anxious. People are more lonely. People are more depressed. So all this has an impact on how we feel, and we're trying ways to deal with all those problems. Whereas maybe the way society is being constructed is part of that problem.
Yeah, 30 seconds, Michael.
Oh, just to continue on with that, then I think we are, as we move to a more automated society, we are causing a lot of problems and anxiety for ourselves. Well, like everybody else, I'd like more time at the till, but I'd like more time with lots of things. Just to come back to one of the older persons related things, we talk about automation, and just to bring in free travel, which is no longer free from Donegal. If you need to book it, need to go by bus errand to Dublin, you have to reserve your seat, and that's a cost of €2, and you need to be internet literate to do that. I think that's a huge problem, and if we compare it to our friends in Sligo who have a train, they don't have to do that. So I think that's a big issue for us, and I think I was at the airport recently with a number of older people getting quite anxious as the bus arrived, because there was quite a number of people there, and it was a case of, are we going to get on or not, because we don't have access to do that. So I think, we're causing problems wholesale where we don't necessarily need to do so.
All right, Michael, listen, I've really enjoyed your contribution this morning. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Michael McLaughlin, Branch Secretary of the Donegal Labour Party. Dr. Kieran O'Farrie, General Practitioner, thanks for your time as always. Have a lovely day. And last but not least, Grania Hines, member of Letterkenny Active Retirement. Great to have you on the programme. Have a lovely weekend, Grania.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye-bye. Okay. We'll be back with more on the 9 till noon show after we take a break for the news and obituary notices.